No food was left to go to waste. If it grew in our yard, we had to deal with it, whether that was domestic or wild. So the berries, the Saskatoons, the strawberries, the chokecherries. I was particularly zealous in this regard. So particularly since I was primarily in charge of harvesting and not of processing. So I would go out and I would, you know, present my mother at the end of the day with 20 liters of Saskatoons. And she would graciously receive them, only to know that she had to be up to midnight now dealing with Saskatoons or, you know, 10 gallons of mushrooms or whatever it was that I managed to bring home that day. You know, you've heard of the 100-mile diet?
Yeah.
I think those people are cutting themselves a lot of slack. Like 100 yards. 100 yards. You know, that's the test. My family was not immune to the industrialization of food. And part of that happened, you may have learned this in this class, in the 1950s after the war. Like this big industrial capacity had been built up for the war, and then we had all these factories and we needed something to do with them. And so part of it meant that we needed to produce consumers. See, during the Depression and the war, people were conservers, right? They held on to stuff. But that's bad for the economy. Do you know elderly people who still have a tin foil drawer?
I still have a tin foil drawer.
Yeah, wax paper, right? They would keep burnt out light bulbs and old cornflakes boxes, yeah?
This summer, actually, I was working on a house, and we were putting new windows in. And when we pulled the old ones out, we figured out that where the windows were, there used to be cupboards. There was newspapers from the 30s, from the 20s and 30s.
Oh, yeah.
So I was like, just going to put these in
my pocket. So yeah, it's cool reading.
Yeah, it's really interesting. They're all in French, though, so it took some time to get there.
Yeah. And with agriculture, it meant converting agriculture, too. So people had to be converted into consumers, which was hard. And it helped if you started to make stuff that fell apart. Then they would have to buy more. Yeah, planned obsolescence. That worked great. And then in agriculture, during the war, they were making ammonium nitrate for bombs. And they figured out after the war, you could use this for fertilizer. And all the research on poison gases?
Pesticides.
This is great. This is great stuff, right? You know, and so all this agriculture became very much industrialized, which caused a huge migration of people to the cities eventually, because fewer and fewer people were on the farm. It was thought that being a consumer was the good life, and the money was in town. And it was really part of the mystique during that time that you were the cousin or the brother who stayed on the farm, you were just a dumb farmer. The city was the place of progress. You know, it was the happening place. And I think it's to this day it's a rare thing for urban people to encourage their children to become farmers. Pretty rare. Here's the point we were getting to earlier. It has only been in your lifetimes, for those of you who are students, and for those of you who are older, that a majority of the world's people have lived in cities.
We've just passed the threshold. I read today over half the world's population now live in cities.
Yeah, over half the world's population.
Oh, eight.
Yeah. In 1900, there were 1.3 billion people in the world and only 14 cities with over a million people. And in 2000, there were over 400 cities with over a million people in the world. And so what you end up with is this a whole group of people who are estranged from the land and nature. Right? You've heard of nature deficit disorder, probably? That topic.
Just reading the nature principle.
Oh, you are, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're reading that already. And you know how it is with urban kids, and some of you may be from that background, you think that food comes from the grocery store or from McDonald's, right? And it's such a shock when urban kids go out to a farm and find out that a potato grows in the ground. I have some nieces and nephews in grade school, nieces and nephews in Ontario, and Paul and I were discussing, you know, getting meat from local farmers here, and their parents shushed us because they didn't want to deal with the fallout from the fact if their children found out that meat came from animals.
Oh, dear. What?
Oh, there's that dying process in the middle there.
Yeah, there's that yeah, that slaughtering and dying process.
I feel like that's better than the not dying. And
yeah,
harvesting.
And so, and I...
Good point.
I don't know if that's my tired mind.
I don't have my bacon strips up.
I know. All these children, all these chickens with prosthetic devices. And we had the three-legged deer go by our house this morning. Tripod. Yeah.
There's a three-legged deer?
Yeah. So, it's kind of funny. And so what we have now is a lot of urban people figure that nature is simply for aesthetics and recreation. Like, you know, you want to go out and see beautiful places, and you want to go out and play in nature. But this idea that nature is our source of life, it's our food. Lately, I've taken to joking tongue-in-cheek that at Augustana, we offer outdoor education for those who don't know how to garden. So, you know, because we need this, a way to reconnect. So, I'm coming to the end here. And I guess part of the farm background was, you know, the industrialization of agriculture. This migration to the cities. Highway 21 was paved in 1965, the year I was born. And that meant people no longer bought their staples at the Wenzel store in New Sarepta or at the meat market or the creamery, but they drove into Edmonton and bought it at the Safeway store, which is now the Value Village on White Avenue. Right? And so processed food became the norm. Even in our family, do you remember blocks of Velveeta cheese?
Yeah.
Sort of a pre-runner of Cheese Whiz? You knew that was processed because when you broiled it, it formed a skin over the top, like an old paint can. It was kind of... you remember that? You understand? That was great stuff, man.
Still working that one through.
I know. Still working that. With a Kraft miniature marshmallow? Oh, my goodness. It's the best thing ever. What? Yeah. And the narrative became that for a lot of people that the less you have to do with food, the better. The less you have to do with the production and the processing of food, the better, until you sit down in front of your TV tray. And that was, if you look at old magazines from the 60s, that was the sign of progress. If you as your family could gather around with a TV dray, with a Swanson's dinner, and watch the TV. Sunday. That was the good life. You know. So, have you noticed the reciprocity shelf down in the lower level of the forum? We're not supposed to call it the basement. What's this? Yeah, I think it's the lower level of the forum.
Tell them names are organic.
What?
Tell them names form organically.
That's right. And I watch that shelf from time to time, and what I notice is, and this is complicated, I know and I understand, that processed food will move from that shelf far quicker than ingredients. A can of Chef Boyardee will get snatched up right away before a can of peas, right? Because Chef Boyardee is good. You know.
No, it's gross.
Yeah. Who eats that? You know, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but just I imagine part of it is time pressures or de-skilling around food and what it means to cook. You know, I thought when I was growing up that my...
Question?
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a note on that. I did some field work at the food bank.
Yeah.
And it was the same kind of thing. We'd have all these fresh potatoes and carrots and parsnips, but to know the difference between a parsnip and a carrot, and all of the processed food went first as well, so all this good food is going bad. And it's like,
yeah.
It's
just, yeah, it's just a lot of de-skilling. Yeah, people, we just don't know, right? And it's hard. Just checking on the time here. I thought this was 8:30 we're done, is that, or 8:15?
Yeah.
8:30, okay.
But we need a bit of time too.
Yeah, I'll give you a little bit of time, yeah. So I thought the way I grew up in this sort of homesteader depression, putting everything up, was just normal. That food was just food. And this was the breakthrough moment for me, Jordy. One breakthrough moment happened when I went to university. And I encountered students who lived together but never ate together. And initially I thought it'd go with this. I thought, oh yeah, people have different ways. People have different experiences. But viscerally I knew it was just wrong. This was immoral. How could you live together and not eat together? You know, that was weird. And the second point of realization came through the eyes of another. In 1990, August, Paula, my fiance, and I came to Alberta from Ontario to announce to my parents that we were engaged. And it was August, and my parents weren't farming full scale anymore, but they did have 80 acres and a large garden. And so we arrived, and the next morning we got up and we picked about 80 liters of peas, you know, 4 or 5 gallon pails, and we came in the house and we had breakfast and we shelled peas, had coffee, shelled more peas, had lunch. In the afternoon we froze the peas, and then we went outside and we watered the garden from the rain barrels, and we came inside and we had supper, and then in the evening my mother made pickles, and then we had more coffee, and then we went to bed. The next day, we got up, and we picked 20 liters of raspberries. And then we, had breakfast, and then we sat with cookie trays and sorted through the raspberries, the good ones for freezing or canning, the icky ones for jam, and we sorted, and we made jam, and we canned raspberries, and we froze raspberries, and then we had coffee, and then we had lunch, and then in the afternoon, we went out, and we picked the last of the beans, and we brought them in and we froze them, and then we had supper, and then in the evening we probably went out and watered the garden again. And Paula was kind of cool with this. She's kind of a domestic kind of woman. She thought this was kind of fascinating. But on the third morning, we got up and we went out and we picked another 80 liters of peas, and we came in and we had breakfast, and then we started shelling peas, and around morning coffee time, she pulled me aside, and she said, "You people are obsessed with food." You know, my family in Ontario actually had a garden. We were different that way. We actually had a garden, but we never ate anything out of it. You know, you people are obsessed with food. What you do is not normal. And here I had grown up with the impression that this was just normal. Right? Part of the reason I do this here is because I realize that I know only a fraction of what my homesteader grandparents know about the land and food. And my children know far less than I do. And they are in the top 10% of their peers. And I think once you are estranged from food and the land, It's just that much harder to care. It's that much harder to care, and also you're ignorant. And gardening is not farming. Like, there's a big difference between gardening and farming. But gardening helps you understand farming a little better. You know, it gives you a little window. I cannot feed myself from this backyard. But I think part of it is to maintain that sense of, meat just doesn't come on styrofoam trays. And eggs don't come in plastic boxes. And it's that knowledge, I think, that feeds gratitude. I think that's a good place to stop. So, anyway, are there any questions or comments before you go into logistics mode? You're welcome. Yeah.